And with me now is John Holdren. He's the science advisor to President Obama. And your title actually is assistant to the president, which, as I understand, is the same rank as national security advisor. Do I have that right?
You do have that right.
And I imagine the report that was issued by the White House this week about climate change is certainly a matter of national security.
It is a matter of national security as well as economic and environmental well-being.
Now, John Holdren, what's in this report is not new to people who've been following the science of this issue. Why come out with this report now?
Well, the report is, first of all, part of a long process in the U.S. program on global change research. And the aim of this particular report is to bring together all the available information relating to the impacts of climate change on the United States, broken down by regions and broken down by sectors such as energy, water, agriculture, human health, and so on. The information is not new in the sense that the various pieces have existed in the scientific literature up until now, but what is new is pulling them all together into a single comprehensive picture of what is happening as a result of climate change in the United States, region by region, where people live, where they're experiencing it, and looking similarly at what can be expected going forward if climate change continues on its current trajectory rather than being abated by actions we might take.
Some have said this report is the most dire report on climate change to come out of the White House, and yet it's optimistic. How do you handle that assessment?
Well, I would say that the report is clear in its depiction of the basic facts that climate is changing, that the impacts are already being felt in areas as diverse as agriculture, forestry, fisheries, human health, damage from storms, wildfires, and so on. In that sense, it is a stark report. And in the sense that the projections show all of these adverse impacts getting steadily worse over time if climate change proceeds unabated, it's a stark report. But it's optimistic in the sense that it tells us that if we take appropriate action to reduce the emissions of the heat-trapping pollution that is the main driver of this problem, we can greatly reduce the amount of climate change and the damage from it that occur in the future. And the report is optimistic as well because in looking at the specific ways in which climate is affecting our well-being across this country, it is showing the way to steps we can take to adapt to climate change in ways that will reduce the harm over time.
So walk me through this now a bit. In this report, what happens if we don't act to address climate change?
If we don't act, and indeed if the rest of the world doesn't act, it's important to understand, of course, that this is not a problem that the United States alone can solve. But if we and the rest of the world together fail to take the steps that are needed to sharply reduce the pace of climate change, we are all going to be in for more extreme temperatures, more heat waves, more floods, more droughts, more wildfires, more pest outbreaks, greater stresses on food production, on forestry, on fisheries, greater stresses on human health, both from the stresses of higher temperatures and from the spread of the vectors and pathogens of tropical diseases, which will expand in their geographic range in a warming world.
Help me understand this a little better in terms of more tangible terms. If the world and the United States doesn't address climate change, can you give me a couple of examples where people will really notice this here in the United States?
Well, first of all, I would say we're already noticing it. People are noticing changes in the growing seasons. They're noticing changes in what kinds of trees and other plants live where. They're noticing the increased frequency of wildfires, the increased frequency of floods in the United States. So the place to start is that we really are already experiencing adverse effects of climate change. We have also seen an increase along with temperatures in the frequency of the most powerful tropical storms, hurricanes in the United States, typhoons out in the Western Pacific. What we will see if climate change continues unabated from lack of appropriate action by our society and other societies to reduce its pace and magnitude is all of these kinds of symptoms that I've described will become more severe. Which ones will become more severe most rapidly is difficult to predict, but this report has quite a bit of information about what the most likely possibilities are. And I would say that people in the United States in particular, in the West, are likely to notice increasing difficulties with water shortages as a relatively early, rapidly escalating effect. I think we're liable to experience noticeable increases in the frequency and extent of wildfires in the western United States. We've already seen in the forests of the western United States large impacts from outbreaks of forest pests, the spruce budworm, the pine bark beetle, and we're likely to see a substantial escalation of that, which people will certainly notice. In the longer run, one of the most noticeable effects is likely to be the increase in sea level that comes from a warming world and that we're already experiencing at a rate that is about twice the rate of sea level rise in the 20th century.
So looking at your report, I see that if we don't do anything, we could see as much as a 7 to 11 Fahrenheit degree rise in temperature here in the United States by the end of the century. What would that mean? This is the worst-case scenario. How livable would America be in those circumstances?
Well, first of all, that temperature range, 7 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit, would be the increase in the average temperature across the United States. And there would be places where the increase would be larger, and there would be lots of places where the most noticeable effect would not so much be the change in the average, but the frequency of extremely hot days. You would have in some parts of the country where there might be 10 or 20 days a year over 100 degrees Fahrenheit now, you might have 100 or 150 days a year. That would be in the high scenario in some parts of the country, in parts of the country, again, where you might have 10 or 20 days that were that hot now. You would in the future, with these large increases in average temperature, experience a much larger number of days that exceed what you might call the threshold of very, very hot. And again, that would certainly be noticeable. But other things you would see in that sort of world, you would see in a United States that was on the average 7 or 11 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, great reductions in soil moisture in summer that would have large impacts on agriculture. You would be likely to see in that world a drastic worsening of the conditions conducive to wildfires. You would see, in all likelihood, very significant impacts on agriculture.
Impacts on agriculture? What do you mean?
I mean the productivity of food crops would go down. You wouldn't be able to grow as much corn or wheat on an acre of land as you can grow today because the heat stress on the plants would be damaging their capacity to grow and bear grain.
Any sense of what proportion of our agricultural production we might lose?
There are some very preliminary sorts of estimates in the report. I don't think anybody can really give a single accurate point estimate of what would happen with average temperature 7 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit above the current level. But the experiments and the modeling that has been done up until now would suggest pretty drastic drops in productivity. Now, again, there is the possibility to adapt. We could, with time and investment, develop new strains of food crops that would be able to do somewhat better than the strains we're relying on now in a warmer world. So again, the point is not that there's nothing we can do, but that looking at these projections tells us quite a lot about what we need to do.
So the question, some people say, look, we're on this path. Climate change is inevitable. We're in it now. It's simply going to get worse. And the sense comes up that it may just be too late to do anything. How accurate is that?
I absolutely disagree that it's too late to do anything. What the science shows above all is that the more climate change we get, the more difficult it's going to be to cope with it. And we have opportunities by acting now and in the future to drastically reduce the amount of climate change we're going to be experiencing. I mean, this is a very simple proposition. More is worse, less is better, and we have the opportunity by taking action to make it less. That's what we ought to be doing.
What do we need to do?
We need to be reducing the emissions of heat-trapping pollution, and above all, that's carbon dioxide from burning the fossil fuels from which we get most of our energy today, that is from burning coal and oil and natural gas. What we need to do is to use those fuels more efficiently so we don't have to burn so much of them to get the goods and services that we need from energy. What we need to do is change the technologies we use to burn them so that we can capture a substantial part of the carbon dioxide that would otherwise be released and sequester it away from the atmosphere. We need to use more renewable technologies which don't emit carbon dioxide, or as in the case of sustainably grown biofuels, only emit as much carbon dioxide when they're burned as they removed from the atmosphere when they were grown. We need to see if we can address the obstacles that have impeded the expansion of nuclear energy in this country and elsewhere, because nuclear energy, too, is a way to get electricity that does not emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We need to sharply increase the efficiency of energy end use, the efficiency of our vehicles, of our buildings, of our manufacturing processes. And we need to take steps to slow down and halt deforestation and other land use practices that are adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere along with the burning of fossil fuels.
Tell me, what are our range of options here? You've outlined how difficult things would be if we do nothing. If we do everything, do we still get to avoid more warming here?
There is nothing that we can do to stop a climate change in its tracks. There's a tremendous amount of momentum built into the climate system. We are not yet experiencing the full consequences of the heat-trapping gases we've already added to the atmosphere because of time lags in the way the global climate system responds. So we will see some continuing increase in global surface temperature and regional increases in surface temperatures no matter what we do. But we have a big opportunity to minimize the amount of change we will experience. And to tell you what that means, you really have to look at this, first of all, at the global level, because it is the global concentrations of these heat-trapping pollutants that determine how much the temperature goes up. But the aim that most scientists who study this matter have agreed is one that is still within reach and is highly desirable, would be to stabilize the concentration of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere at a level that would limit the global average surface temperature increase to about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial level. Now, if we do everything right, I think we could achieve that. We would limit the increase to about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. What we're experiencing today is in the range of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial level. If we don't do anything, we will, in all likelihood, by the end of this century, be experiencing temperatures in the range of 7, 8, 10 degrees Fahrenheit on a global average basis above the pre-industrial level. And in other words, temperature increases twice as big or more compared to the pre-industrial level as those we would experience if we take all the appropriate actions. That's a huge difference in terms of the likelihood of unmanageable effects. Right now we're experiencing effects, but they are not overwhelming. and many of them are effects which we could greatly ameliorate with investments in adaptation. But the thing that needs to be understood is that adapting to climate change gets more difficult, more expensive, and less effective the larger are the changes in climate to which you're trying to adapt. And with a combined strategy of taking the steps we need to take to limit the heat-trapping pollution and then adapting to the extent of climate change that those measures cannot succeed in avoiding, we will get the best outcomes. And it requires, again, investments both in reducing the heat-trapping emissions and in starting to adapt to the kinds of climate changes that we'll not be able to completely avoid.
Now, as I understand it, between the United States and China, there are about 40% of the world's emissions of carbon right now. And I also understand that you were in China with the negotiating team on the Global Climate Change Treaty recently. What do we need China to do in order to have a reasonable agreement on limiting greenhouse gases for the world?
Well, first of all, it is correct that China and the United States are the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases in the world. And we do total something in the range of 40% of global emissions. And that means that there is no way that the problem can be solved without both of us taking very significant actions to reduce our emissions. The United States and China are both already doing a number of things to reduce their emissions, but we need to do much more. And it has to be expected because the United States is an advanced industrialized country and China remains a developing country, that the United States, along with the other industrial nations, is going to have to do more sooner with the expectation that China and the other developing countries will follow in trajectories that will peak and begin to decline after some time lag. That is, we can't expect China as a developing country to stabilize its emissions immediately and begin to decline thereafter. My personal judgment would be that the United States and the other industrialized nations should peak no later than about 2015 and be sharply declining in their emissions after that, and that China and other developing countries need to peak between 2020 and 2025 and be sharply declining after that.
And your personal views, how do those jibe with what is going on in the international negotiations to replace the Kyoto Protocol? The Europeans, industrial nations, the other industrial nations say the U.S. should have our levels 25-40% below 2005 levels. Is that the appropriate level that the U.S. should be reducing its emissions?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say that I think the target that President Obama has enunciated, which is to be about 14% below our 2005 emissions by 2020, is a good target. It's one I think we can meet, and it is adequate if followed by subsequent continuing declines to achieve, assuming the rest of the world also acts in a responsible way, to achieve the sort of stabilization of atmospheric concentrations that I talked about that could limit the global average temperature increase to around 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I think arguments about whether the United States has to go deeper than that by 2020 are not particularly productive or informative, in part because what matters is not so much the emissions in a single year, but the cumulative emissions over periods of time. And if you argue too much about what the ideal position to be in 2020 is, you may end up having nothing but arguments and no agreement. What we need is to get moving in the United States. We need to get a bill out of the Congress and signed by the president that puts in place the sort of mechanisms needed to get us on a declining trajectory. And we need that bill sooner rather than later. I would prefer not to spend the next 5 years arguing about exactly where we need to be in 2020, but spend it instead getting going with a national economy-wide cap-and-trade approach to limiting the heat-trapping pollution that will get us ultimately where we need to go.
John Holdren, what's different now in your own life, in your personal life, now that you know that this climate change is coming?
Well, of course, the biggest thing that's different in my personal life is I'm now the science and technology advisor to the President of the United States, working with other people in the executive branch and across the government to try to get the sort of policies that we need to successfully address this problem. It's a great privilege to be able to do that after spending many years studying these problems and writing about them and exhorting about them from the outside. I'm very happy indeed to be in a position where I might be able to have some influence on the outcome. And I have to say it's also a particular privilege to be able to be doing this for this particular president, who understands this problem very well. He understands that we have no choice but to solve it. And he also understands that this challenge is also an opportunity, that we can address the climate change challenge in ways that create new businesses, new jobs in developing and deploying the clean energy technologies that we're going to need to get this done.
When might we expect a detailed statement from the president about the way forward on climate change?
Well, of course, the president, starting even in the campaign, has made a variety of statements about the problem, including both what the targets need to be and quite a lot about what the solutions are going to be. He has proposed, for example, the expenditure of $150 billion over a period of a decade on the clean energy technologies that we're going to need to do what we need to do in the way of emissions reductions. He's been very specific about that. He's been specific not only about where we need to be in 2020, but about what the trajectory has to be out to 2050, when the United States needs to be something in the range of 80% below the 2005 emissions, if the whole world is to be on a trajectory consistent with doing the best we can do at limiting climate change. There are very specific measures in the FY 2010 budget and in the stimulus package, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, dealing with clean energy technologies and other aspects of climate change and climate change research. And you will be seeing more as time goes on.
More?
More specifics about the measures both in the energy technology domain and in other aspects of responding to this climate change challenge.
So there you are in the executive office building. You're at the White House. If for a moment the proverbial magic wand was put in your hand to do anything about this, what would be the first thing you would do?
The first thing I would do is get enough votes in the House and in the Senate to pass a comprehensive energy and climate bill.
The second thing?
The second thing I would do is advise the president to sign it.
And the third thing?
The third thing I would do is work with industry, government, NGOs, universities, and so on to generate the degree of innovation in energy technology that will enable us to meet those targets in the most cost-effective possible way.
As science advisor, what's the one thing that you'd love to do that you just can't do?
Take vacations.
The climate's not waiting, is it?
The climate is not waiting, nor are the other issues. It would be wrong to suppose that the only issue in which the science and technology advisor to the president needs to be paying attention is climate change. The climate and energy challenge is a big one, but we also need to be focused on technological innovation for economic recovery and growth. We need to be focused on science and technology to help us with the health care challenge, how we get better outcomes for all Americans at lower costs. We need to focus on the science and technology of other resource and environmental issues beyond just the energy and climate issue. And we have a whole variety of needs in the science and technology area having to do with national and homeland security. So it's a busy place here.
Quickly, before you go, on space policy, what's your view of the space program? To what extent should humans be headed into space?
Well, we have a multifaceted space program. The facets include human exploration of space, but also robotic exploration. They include looking down as well as looking up, that is, using space as a place from which to observe what's happening on Earth with our various kinds of Earth-observing satellites that help us track and predict the weather. track and predict hurricanes, understand what changes we're making in the face of the earth in terms of, for example, deforestation. We have in NASA both a technology challenge and fundamental science programs that are very important. We have aeronautics as well as space. And the great challenge for NASA and for the country in this domain is to figure out how to reconcile all these different missions in an era of necessary budgetary constraint. We're going to continue to have a space program. It's going to continue to have a human dimension as well as a robotic exploration dimension. But we have to balance all the things that NASA has to do, the looking up and the looking down, the aeronautics and the astronautics, the robotic and the human. We're going to figure out how to get all of that done.
You have a blue ribbon panel that's looking at what NASA should be doing. What do you expect them to come to you with?
Well, the blue ribbon panel that we've started and, in fact, which had its first public meeting as we speak on June 17th, the blue ribbon panel that had its first public meeting on June 17th is focused on the options for human spaceflight. It is not reviewing the whole NASA agenda. It is looking specifically at the challenges we face in the human dimension of our space program. How are we going to continue to get U.S. astronauts into space after the space shuttle comes to the scheduled end of its life at the end of 2010? How are we going to get the maximum use out of the International Space Station? How are we going to get back to the moon and beyond in an expeditious way, given the other challenges and constraints that we have to deal with? So that's the focus of that panel being led by Norm Augustine, and we expect from them in August a report that tells us whether we are best off by staying on the current trajectory or whether we need to make some modifications in that trajectory in order to maximize what we can do in the U.S. human spaceflight program.
Quickly, two more questions. On another topic, you know, President Obama has called nuclear terrorism the most immediate and extreme threat to global security. This is part of your portfolio, your knowledge of this. I realize that much of this obviously is shrouded in national security concerns and secrecy, but how worried should we be?
Well, I think, as in with many other problems, we shouldn't be so worried that we are paralyzed or unable to face all the other realities in our daily lives. This is a significant challenge: how to avoid terrorism with weapons of mass destruction, which could be biological as well as nuclear. It is a challenge I believe we've made significant progress toward getting our arms around over the last 15 years or so. And we're going to have to keep making progress to make sure we stay ahead of the terrorists in our capacity to prevent these kinds of events.
Back to climate change. Assess for me the odds of President Obama going to Copenhagen at the conclusion of the current round of international negotiations on climate change. Will he be there, do you think?
I simply cannot comment on that. I just don't know at this juncture. It will obviously depend on a whole array of issues in terms of what's on the president's plate at the time and whether it appears that there would be a significant benefit from his going to Copenhagen. And I think it's much too early to predict how that will come out.
If the president didn't go to Copenhagen, it would mean that the negotiations hadn't worked. How dire would that be for the future of the planet and for those of us here in the United States living under the conditions of climate change that you outline in your report?
First of all, I'm not sure that the president not going would mean the negotiations had failed. It might mean the negotiations had succeeded without him, and he didn't need to go. He could simply celebrate the success from Washington. But the second thing I would say is we do need an agreement in Copenhagen. I think it's very important that we get one. The United States is approaching Copenhagen. The United States government is approaching Copenhagen with a positive attitude, with a belief that we can get it done in Copenhagen. And we're working very hard with our various international partners to make sure that that happens. But the most important single thing the United States can do to ensure success in Copenhagen is to get its own house in order by passing a comprehensive energy climate bill and having that legislation in place when our negotiators go off to Copenhagen, because that will demonstrate that the United States is finally prepared to take the leadership role that the world expects of us in addressing this challenge.
Your time that you spent with the Chinese, how confident are you that the United States and China are going to be able to come to a bilateral agreement, which will be crucial to an overall settlement in Copenhagen?
I am hopeful that the United States and China will both reach positions in terms of their own policies and the commitments they're prepared to make in Copenhagen that will be seen by the world as not just sufficient, but real leadership from these two countries that are the two largest emitters. One, the largest industrial country emitter, and the other, the largest developing country emitter, as well as the largest emitter overall. I wouldn't say I'm confident at this point, but I am optimistic.
John Holdren is President Obama's science advisor. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.